You're listening to Atheistically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Atheistically Speaking. This is episode 264, and I'm your host, Thomas Smith. All right, we're gearing up for part two with Sarah Hayter. Part one had a great response, a really good interview. People liked it a lot. And part two, I think, is even better because we start debating a bit about discourse and a lot of the things you've heard me talk about before. And it's a good, healthy debate. I like it. So Sarah pushed back quite a bit on these ideas, and I think we're all better for it because we can consider both sides and make up our minds. So thanks for listening, and let's get to part two with Sarah Hayter. We could talk a bit about specifically why Islam might pose a bigger threat than any other religion. We started talking about that a little bit, but what do you think it is in the religion that makes it so that it's a particular possible danger to, I don't know, the world, to everybody, I guess, whereas other religions maybe aren't as much right now?
Well, I mean, it's not entirely what's in the religion. It's also the attitudes of the believers and the way that Christianity has really been, if I'm focusing on Christianity in particular, but how it's just been declawed in a lot of ways, and the way that secularism has really taken away political power from Christianity. That has not happened with Islam. Muslims are still very devout. They still believe they hold themselves more closely to the teachings of the Quran. So even if we can say that the Quran and the Bible are exactly the same in terms of how much violence they can justify, even if we start with the assumption that they're both exactly the same, Islam would still be a bigger danger to society just based on those two other factors alone, because believers take it more seriously. Believers who are Muslim, they stick more closely to the teachings of their religion, and their governments tend to be intertwined with the mosque.
Do you think that's an accident, or do you think that in itself is also a product of what's in the books, you know?
Yeah, that's something I could talk about for days. I think that's a very interesting conversation. I'm of the opinion that it is something that is a little bit more inherent to Islam than it is to other religions. Mm-hmm. Islam to me feels like it's a political religion. It's difficult to separate politics and Islam. And I know that Muslim reformers like Majid Nawaz, that's his, sort of his crusade, is to separate political Islam from, you know, just a private faith. I don't know to the extent that's possible. From my understanding of Islam, or at least the way that I was taught it, it's one of those religions that will take the victories that it has promised will take place in the real world. You know, they're not going to take place in the hereafter. They're going to happen, and you have an active role to play in that. I mean, that's how I understood it. I would have to have a better understanding of Christianity to really make a great comparison.
Right, of course. Well, there's the passage that people cite, render unto Caesar. I don't know. I'm sure.
Yeah, render the whole two kingdoms, kingdom of God and or kingdom of heaven and kingdom. Is that a thing? Is that a theory?
Well, I don't know. The passage I was talking about is just the verse that says, render unto Caesar what is Caesar's, and God what is God's, or whatever. But so that, and it came up when I think someone was trying to trap Jesus into not paying a tax because he thought, again, like he didn't have to because he's the son of God. But then in that passage, he says, no, render unto Caesar what is Caesar's. And so I don't know if the Quran has an analog, you know, if it has something like that. Maybe that could be part of it. I don't know.
As far as I know, nothing that clear. Mm-hmm. or not, there are obviously, I mean, in any text that's longer than, you know, you can always find things. You can try and mold them in the way that you would like. I don't think that there has been that history either, because the way that the Quran has been interpreted also matters, because there's a whole, scholarly tradition, and that tradition matters also, of Quranic interpretations and various schools of thought. And as far as I know, it's more involved in politics, more actively involved in politics than Christianity. And I feel that that is inherent in Islam. I feel like that is one of those things that's going to be very difficult, maybe more difficult than it has been with Christianity, to change. But, you know, I support Majid Nawaz, and I support his mission, and I think what he's doing is very valuable. So even if I don't agree with it, I'll support it.
And
hope that he can, hope that he can change hearts and minds. I'm not so sure.
Yeah, Majid is really interesting, and the thing about the cartoon was just, that's crazy, where he tweeted that he wasn't offended by a Jesus and Mo cartoon, I think. And just him saying that was offensive so much to Muslims that he got just nonstop bash from it, right?
It's interesting. He is maligned by Muslims all the time. So this is, I think, a very good exercise to see where we are exactly. You know, we are in a place where somebody like Majid Nawaz, if you read his books, if you read his, the things he says, they're reasonable. They're totally reasonable. In fact, they're not progressive enough for someone like me at all, right? And if it wasn't for the fact that now I feel like I have these strange bedfellows, I have these Muslims who I don't agree with in a lot of ways, but we have some goals in common, and he's much more reasonable than
the fact that he's trying to accomplish reform. Like, it's almost a compromise of, like, you're not going to turn devout Muslims into, hippies or something. Like, there's got to be a bit of a bridge. So maybe that's part of it.
What I would say is, I don't know how active it can be. I don't think that's what happened with Christianity. I don't think Christians thought, I don't think Christians thought when they were, I mean, humanism is, it began with Christians, right? There were Christians who were, the earliest humanists were Christians. And they, I think, from my understanding, they thought they were going to get closer to God, and especially with their understanding of the natural world. You're going to understand the natural world, you're going to get closer to God. You're going to get, you're going to...
Yeah, there were schools of thought of, like, God has given us our senses and our reason and stuff. So therefore, if we use it, we'll be getting closer to him. Is that the kind of thing you're talking about?
Right. And also just, they didn't, I don't think they saw the danger that secularism posed, or liberalism in general posed. They couldn't have seen it. It hadn't happened before. But Islam has the ability now to look at the example of Europe.
Well, there was a long period of struggle between church and state, I think, in the Western world. And maybe, Islam, it sounds like it just hasn't had that yet. Is there a Islamic state or that's a bad phrase. I'm sorry. Is there a Muslim country you can think of that has that more of a struggle between church and state and not so much of a cooperation that there seems to be?
You can. Technically, all of them do a little bit. I mean, the secular rulers and the, but it's different. It's not like the people versus the church. It's more like the church and the secular rulers.
Oh, they're like kind of vying for power, sort of thing.
Right. Yeah.
That's kind of how it went with Christianity a little bit. So maybe that's a good sign. I don't know. But so, I was going to ask you, do you have any particular insight? And it's okay if you don't, because I know, your upbringing was pretty specific and all that. And we've talked about how you may or may not be like a typical kind of experience of being a Muslim. But do you have any insight as to the question that I think is talked about a lot in atheism and in regressive left debate, that kind of thing, as to whether or not Islam provides the fuel for things like terrorist attacks and suicide terrorism and that kind of thing? Do you have any thoughts on that? Like, do you think the religion fuels that? Or do you think, like, there are some people whose theory is, no, these are just, that's not separate from the religion. Islam doesn't cause this terrorism. But what do you think on that?
Well, I think it's one of the, it's nonsense to say that there isn't a relation. Of course there's a relation.
Is it a relation to even to mainstream Islam? Maybe that's a point people make.
Here's what I could say. It's not, if you are a Muslim, it is not necessarily true that you will eventually progress into a jihadi. I think that's wrong.
Sure.
So
yeah,
there are some people who see, you know, all Muslims as jihadis and training. That's not
Which
true.
Of course, I mean, there's 1.6 billion. Of course, there's not 1.6 billion jihadis. Yeah.
And it's just, it's not true. And some of them might even become more devout and still not not follow that vein of thought.
Okay.
However, that vein of thought does stem from the same religion that, you know, 1.6 billion people follow. It's the same.
It's a different like, stream core. Of it, like a different kind of interpretation.
It's starting from that. And then they sort of, I would say they are more tied down to the fundamentals of religion than are many other people.
Right.
A lot of people have made this argument, and I'm sort of in that camp, that there's a lot that some of these extremists do that, you know, you can find examples in the with the story of the prophet and his conquerings and his justifications for them that's similar to what some of these extremists have been doing. But it's wrong to say that it will necessarily be that if you are a Muslim, you know, I think that's
the
train of thought that's scary, that where people say if you're a Muslim, you're necessarily bound to become this, but you're not. There's a lot of ways to avoid that.
How far would you go? Does mainstream Islam give any sort of shield to that way of thinking, or can we separate it? Can we say, no, mainstream Muslims have no blame whatsoever to bear for something like, you know, Islamic jihadis or whatever? Or is it, do you think there's a little bit of responsibility? None? What range do you think that is? Does it provide a shield for them?
Well, I think, I mean, you can look at it as if you would look at, you know, people who blow up abortion clinics, right? There's that extremist who does that, who thinks that, okay, a life for a life, I'm going to murder a murderer. Right. And then there's a large amount of Christians who are anti-abortion and they think that it's murder. And they, you know, and to some extent provide shield for those extremists, or at least they provide shield for their their ideology. You know, they give justifications for that ideology and those extremists just take it one step further. And then there's mainstream Christians who are sort of, you know, maybe sort of anti-abortion and sort of provide shield for those other guys. So I think it's just, it's something that just builds on, you know, one shell at a time until you get to progressive Muslims. And I think even progressive Muslims have a role to play and they have a responsibility in this, because if they're not pulling their fellow Muslims to be like them, you know, if they're not pressuring them to be less extreme, less dogmatic, then they have a little bit of responsibility in this too. We all do, you know, I think in that sense, like we can all play a role in this that's positive. We can all make this reality a little bit better, a little bit easier. But to the extent that some people say that it's all Muslims, it's not all Muslims. Westerners also have a role to play. Leftists have a role to play.
Hmm. What do you see that role as?
Well, I think that, and I talked about this a little bit in my speech, but I think there's so much of the left has abandoned the causes that they purport to care about, you know, like women's rights, gay rights, minority rights. When it comes to Islam, it seems like if you're from a Muslim community, then you're exempt from all these other rules. You know, they'll bring down the hammer to misogynists in a Western context, right? Like men are manspreading or whatever it is that they're doing. Mm-hmm. And they're treated as criminals.
Yeah, for spreading your legs on a train a little bit.
That's that's a little unfair of me. Kind of one of those absurd things.
No, I was going with you. I think that's true. I think people will focus on that to an insane degree. And then when it comes to, if it's somebody who, you know, looks like a Muslim, they're not going to be as quick to criticize their behavior.
And I think that comes from a place where, you know, they're trying not to be racist, but it's one of those things where the intent, it isn't enough. You really have to do it with reason, and you have to do it rationally. And in this sense, I think it leads you into a less forgivable racism, which is to say that you will allow powerful people in brown communities to oppress others in brown communities, you know, so, and it's okay because they're just doing it to each other. I've known FGM people who have sort of been FGM apologists.
Oof.
And they have all been leftists. Some of them, a few of them, even
that's a
people
great
who
point.
Would otherwise be be feminists.
Yeah, I've never heard a Republican defend FGM. Like,
right.
Wow. Yeah, I've never quite thought about it in those terms.
So to me, that's very hard for me to forgive. It's very hard for me to then look at the left and say, well, you don't have, you're not racist. You are the anti-racist people. You are the anti-misogynist people. Because you're not for people like me. Only for other white people, you know, other Americans or whatever it is. Not for people like me. And that's very disheartening because I came into, and I call myself still a leftist. I'm still left-leaning in the great majority of my politics. Uh-huh. But I came into it because I thought the left stood for secularism. I thought the left stood for women's rights, for minority rights, for pluralism. And now I sort of feel like I've been deceived because to some extent it seems like that doesn't apply to everybody.
Hmm.
It only applies to some people. It only applies to people that are in the Western world. And so in the Western world, yeah, let's tackle misogynists. In the Western world, yeah, let's hammer anybody who disagrees with us in terms of racial politics or whatever it is. And, you know, for a long, I was with them. I was with them because I thought they would also be with me when it came to tackling things like the hijab, modesty culture in general in the East. I thought they would be with me there as in the way that I was with them here. But I have found that that's not really been the case. And so that's been a constant struggle for me to feel that, you know, my people don't really care about me.
Yeah, that's a really interesting thing. I remember actually years ago, it may have even predated all my podcasts, which is going to be a while ago. I started podcasting in 2010, but I remember getting into an argument with a feminist back when, you know, arguments happened on Facebook. Now it's just, you know, pictures of your dogs or your kids or whatever. But there was a time when Facebook was at least for me and for my circles, more political and involved arguments and stuff. And I got in an argument with a feminist because I don't know if I was right or wrong, but my what I was expressing was I was lamenting the fact that people in the Middle East and women could be and I use the term, and I want to get your take on this, if this is offensive or if this is what you would say, women are the women who are quote unquote brainwashed into thinking that the hijab and all these coverings and everything, niqab or whatever it may be, like are a good thing. And I use the term brainwashed. I said, yeah, I mean, maybe they're saying that they like it, but don't you think they've been brainwashed by this religion? And there's a whole feminist kind of, I guess, view that even suggesting that a woman could be brainwashed is like anti-feminist.
Which is outrageous, right? Because they will say that they would, if you talk to them about, you know, 1950s housewives,
yeah,
in America, they will say, yeah, oh yeah, a bunch of them were brainwashed. If you tell them about all the women that were anti-suffragettes, you know, they were anti-suffrage.
Oh,
in general,
yeah, yeah.
And
they
demonized
suffragettes, yeah,
right?
Yeah.
There were quite a few, and it was some of them, you know, there were women that were leading the anti-suffrage cause too. You would, they would look back on that and they would say, of course, they were just brainwashed.
Mm-hmm.
Or
I should have asked that. Damn, that's a good point. What would you say about a housewife in the 50s? Yeah, yeah.
They would even say that right now, today, to women who say that they are not feminist. You know, the women don't even have to say they're anti-feminist. Women, if a woman says she's not a feminist, they're going to say she is brainwashed. She has been... I don't know the exact terms that the terminologies that they use anymore, but various ways of saying that she just has been taught to hate herself, and she doesn't she just doesn't understand what it means.
Yeah.
And you know it.
In your view, then people are brainwashed by religion, you know, and they're brainwashed into doing things that are not necessarily good for them, and maybe thinking that they are good for them. Would you say?
Sure. I mean, that happens. That happens all the time. It's not just religion. Tons of ideologies have this hypnotizing, you know, almost religion-like, but like dogmatic way of thinking that you get trapped into. It's human almost to just fall back on that. It's easier for us anyway. It's a mental trap. It's difficult to be a person who is rationally thinking in all aspects of life. It's an active role that your brain has to take, and our minds want an easy way out. They want to conserve energy. They don't want to have to worry about this, and they want to be able to just take shortcuts, and they do. So it's just a strange thing for me to have this conversation. And you're not, you know, the only one that's had this conversation with feminists. I've had this conversation with feminists all the time. And it's absurd for me to have to sit there and defend this to somebody who has lived in the Western world, has really never faced the kind of misogyny that you see in Muslim cultures, never will, you know, has no fear of that sort of thing, can worry about something like manspreading. you know, and then they're the ones that are saying, well, you know, the hijab is empowering.
Yeah.
Like, well, that's just.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it gives me pause, and probably me more so because, you know, I'm your typical white male. They always have that out of, well, you're just a typical white male, so you can, you know, say that people are of color or brainwashed or whatever. But so it did give me pause. I was like, shit, am I being an asshole? Am I saying something?
But you're not, you the know? Only one. Yeah. It's not as if, you know, the only people that are not allowed to criticize religion in this way or Islam in this way are white males. That's not true. That's what they say. They paint them all as old white men that hate Islam. But it's, you know, Ayaan Hirsi Ali gets a lot of hate for doing what she's doing. I can't actually think of anybody, and I've said this before in some other podcast where I said, where can you think of anybody who criticizes Islam publicly, visibly, you know, and gets away with it? You know, who in the sense that they can criticize Islam directly and talk about it directly as an issue and not be called a racist, not be called a bigot, not be called xenophobe or an Uncle Tom or a native informant or whatever it is. I can't think of anybody.
Yeah, I can't either.
I don't know anyone who's escaped this. Well, so is it even possible to do?
We'll open it to the audience. Email us if you think of somebody, but I can't think of anybody. It's a good point.
Well, I think that says a lot about where we are and about why people are so angry when it comes to this topic of Islam, why it's so polarizing. I think it has everything to do with the political climate today. I think we talked a little bit about Trump, or you tweeted mm-hmm. at me or something about Trump.
Oh yeah, shit. I'm so glad you remember. That was like one of the main things I want to talk about. Let's get into that. So you said that you think the left is responsible for Trump. Now I get that it's Twitter, so feel free to clarify, you know, it's you're using 140 characters or whatever, but that the left is responsible for Trump. Now I happen to disagree, but I'm open-minded. Like I would love to hear a case for why the left is responsible.
Well, to clarify my Twitter comments, I don't think they are solely responsible.
Sure, sure.
Right? It's not, of course there's a climate that has been that has been fostered by right-wing media outlets and, you know, various demagogues that has allowed a character like this to gain traction. But the left has a lot to do with it. The current culture of I think in a variety of ways, Islam is a big topic. Islam is a big failing of the left. And I think that people see it to be a failing. People see it to be a case where the left is being very disingenuous, because we have a president that's saying, you know, Islam is a religion of peace, right after terrorist attacks, which I think it's a very absurd thing to say. And he doesn't have to say it. You know, if he wanted to, the effect of just protecting Muslims, all he has to say is, you know, this, you have Muslim neighbors who care about this country and love this country, and they're with us and we're with them. And there are many Muslims who don't believe in this, and that's fine. That's a fine thing to say. It's another thing to get into, you know, to essentially Quranic interpretation and say Islam is or isn't anything. You know, he's making a statement about what the religion is versus what the people are. It's one thing to say that the people are peaceful, and I think that's a fair statement, and I think that's something everyone should say and talk about. But it's not fair to say that the religion is necessarily this way or that way, or, you know, doesn't have anything to do with this. I think that's an absurd thing for a president to say, and he said it repeatedly. And it's that sort of thing where if you're somebody, you know, you're the average American, you hear something like this after, you know, a terrorist attack, and you have little, you know, you have little background knowledge about this. You don't really understand why this is happening. Why are they coming after us? Why are they attacking us like this? And you hear your president say that and nothing else, and offer no real explanations for why people from this religious background do this. I think it makes them distrust that leader. And I think that it has led to a distrust of the left. And I think that that is something somebody like Donald Trump has pounced upon. You know, it's a kernel of truth that he can own. You know, not only can he's the only one that's really talking. He's the only one that says, okay, Islam is a problem. And he says it unflinchingly. He just says it. And that gains a lot of credibility in the eyes of other people. And they can say that, okay, this is somebody we can trust to tell us the truth when Hillary Clinton won't, when Barack Obama won't. And I think that plays into his hands. And a lot of people have said this. I'm not the only one. I think there's been many people.
I actually think I'm in the minority in disagreeing. If you don't mind, let me give you my thoughts on it, and feel free to, you know, come right back at me, or we can agree to disagree, or maybe I'll be wrong. That's okay. But my thoughts on that, and I actually did used to think that as well. But then I thought, what is the decision-making process that a voter should be going through? If we're going to look – now, and I think you're right. I think definitely it's not helpful for Obama to say things like that, to say blanket Islam is a religion of peace, period. Like I'm not saying that's good by any means. And I certainly think that anything a leader like that says that is, you know, kind of, you know, not really true and is kind of – goes against what people's perceptions tend to be, that is going to create distrust. So I think we agree insofar as that. But when you actually get to the point where you're going to be voting and you see one guy who's not to even mention all the other absurd qualities about Donald Trump and how unfit he is for office in every way, if you see him say, well, we need to not let Muslims in and until we know what's going on, which is that's not a solution to anything, by the way. Like, that's not – that wouldn't have even prevented the terrorist attacks that he's thinking it would have prevented because they weren't immigrant. I mean, at a certain point, can't we reasonably say voters have a responsibility to look at it rationally and say – and even if they're not going to, that's fine. But if voters are irrational, then I don't think we can blame people for that, you know. So what they would have to do is say, okay, Trump's solutions, which is absurd, which is bar all Muslims from coming into the country, something that's not, I don't even think is legal, and is certainly he's underinformed on every issue that you ask him about, knows very little about it except he feeds on that, you know, kind of racist tendency in the party versus look at Obama. Now, sure, his words have said, oh, Islam is a religion of peace, yada, yada, yada. Meanwhile, he's droning the shit out of people over in the Middle East. Like, it's not like he's treating the Middle East with kid gloves and is giving them our nuclear weapons and stuff. Like, I mean, you could say the Iran deal isn't great or something, but he's still fighting ISIS. He's still, you know, killing leaders over there. Couldn't we say a reasonable voter should look at the two approaches and say, all right, I'll go with the one where the guy is maybe he's being a politician. He's speaking out of both sides of his mouth or whatever versus the madman.
So I don't want to come across as somebody who's trying to rally for Trump. I am not. what I mean to say solely, this is what I mean to say, is that if you are a politician, yes, you have a responsibility to gain the trust of your voters, and we talked about this a little bit, right? And how I think Obama is failing in that aspect, but also to show them that you will represent their interests. And this has also been something that leftist politicians in general have failed upon. As far as the trust thing is concerned, I think it's more than trust. It's a belief that he is authentic. You know, that he is
sure.
He is saying what is on his mind, and he's doing what is on his mind, and he's not being pressured by anybody else. I'm not saying to you that this is I think just to make it clear, I'm going to vote for Hillary.
Oh yeah, no, don't worry.
That is the educated. I don't want to get into it. But.
Well, I agree, and I'm glad to hear you say that. But yeah, I think the argument is still separate from that. It's
people. I think people are tired of being shamed by elites, and especially elitist media. Now, I don't want to sound like, you know, Sarah Palin when she goes off about the media, but I think that it is true, and it's fair to say that, you know, people are shamed, and there's a large part of the American population that is consistently shamed for not being informed enough, educated enough, tolerant enough, inclusive enough, or whatever it is, right? They're made to feel not just that their ideas are wrong, and that's one thing, but that they are buffoons, and they are hateful, and they are, you know, primitive, and just not as cosmopolitan as these elitists. And I think that that's a real feeling. And that's not... it's not unfair to say that the media sometimes, you know, have a role to play in creating this sort of atmosphere. And this man refuses to be shamed, right? And so I remember back in, like, I think it was like November of last year, and I was telling everybody that I was getting scared. I was thinking, okay, Trump is rising, and you don't see it, but he's going to get stronger, and he's going to be the Republican nominee. And people laughed at me. You know, my friends, they suggested, you're silly, this is ridiculous, like, of course he's not, he's a clown. And I said, no, he's latching into a very raw feeling that many Americans are feeling. And in order to be an effective politician, in order to be a good politician, you have to be able to understand that people are feeling this hurt or this pain or whatever, justifiably or unjustifiably, they're feeling it, and I need to harness it and pull it into a good direction, in a direction that'll be good for the country. And if you don't do that, you allow people like Trump to take the reins. And that's essentially what's happened. So he refuses to be shamed. And when everyone, it's not as if when he says, you know, there's blood coming out of her vagina, like, Trump supporters are necessarily agreeing with him there or thinking that that's true. What they're liking about him is that he says what's on his mind, and you can't embarrass him. You know, because he doesn't care about what you think. And this is juxtaposed to Hillary, who seems very, you know, polished and rehearsed, and she doesn't come across as authentic. And the message that people are learning from Trump is that this candidate thinks for himself, and he doesn't let anyone bully him into repressing who he is. Of course, I mean, of course, that's ridiculous, but that is what they're thinking. That is what they're thinking.
Well, yeah, but a lot of what this is – okay, there's two particular things that I think are interesting here. First, I think we would need to separate whether when people say the left is responsible for Trump, do they mean more so than they would be for any other Republican candidate? Because I think that's important to parse out, because don't you forget, you know, don't let no one forget – Ted Cruz said we should monitor Muslim communities.
No, I think more so than any candidate. I think Trump in particular. I wouldn't say that for Cruz. I wouldn't say that for Ted Cruz. I'm saying that for Donald Trump.
Oh, wow. So you think – but the things you just said, though, they apply to Ted Cruz. Like, Ted Cruz said we should patrol mosques. Like, he said some outrageous stuff that's not PC. He refuses to be shamed. He's got all the same qualities. But
I don't think he does. I don't think he has. Well, I don't think okay, he has the right. same he's, maverick feel that Trump
that's,
has.
That's fair, but he. I think he has
Harvard
some of the
grad. You know, mm-hmm. he's been in the biz of politics for much longer than Trump has. So I think he has. I think he has a very different feeling.
So then is that the difference, that Trump is more of an outsider? Because I didn't. I was trying to take the things that you said and respond to them and say that Cruz has a lot of those factors.
I don't know if he does, though. I don't. I think. I don't know if Cruz is the refusing to be shamed kind of thing. Like, I don't think he has it in the same sense that Trump has. Has he said the same sort of offensive things as Trump has?
Well, like I just said, he said we should patrol Muslim communities. That's about the most offensive thing. I mean,
when did he say it, though?
He said it
after the Trump thing.
Well, I don't know. It was that debate. It was one of the, probably, who knows, the second to last debate or something, where, I mean, they all, you could make the argument that Trump ramped it up for all of them. That's certainly true. But I just,
he brought it to another level. I mean, there was the plane that everybody else was playing in. There was what Trump was doing. And also he doesn't care what the Republican establishment thinks of him either. And I think what he stands for is a candidate that is anti-PC. And I don't think that Cruz has that same vibe. I don't think that Cruz gives off that same feeling. But Trump does.
Okay, well, okay, let me just clarify. The point I was going to make is, and there's actually an early debate among the Republicans where Fiorina said, and you know it's early because Fiorina was in it. Mm-hmm. She said she gave a speech about how PC culture was like ruining everything. So the point I was going to make is, I think that's a Republican thing. Like most Republican candidates had, I think you could point to a time where they said people are being too PC, people are blah, blah, blah. And so I'm not sure I see how in particular Trump and none of the others are a product of the left. You know what I mean?
I don't think they all are to the extent Trump is. I wouldn't, for example, Bush. Would you have said that about Bush? I think Jeb is
a product.
We forgot about Jeb.
Yeah. You had to remind me. Please clap. Jeb, I would say is definitely, that's an establishment thing. He's a product of the Republican establishment for sure. And not really, I mean, I actually, the funny thing about this whole process of watching all these debates and how awful I think Trump is and everything is I ended up liking Jeb. I was like, oh, come on. Vote for Jeb, everybody.
I would say I started liking almost every, except for Cruz, who I thought Cruz would have been worse.
Yeah.
But I think it's to the extent that it's the left's fault, quote unquote, for making somebody like Trump, is that they've fostered this PC culture, and I know it's such a soundbite. It's such a thing that, you know, right-wing pundits talk about all the time. But I do think that there is a grain of salt in there. And I think it's hard to deny where, we're in the society where if you say anything critical about the religion of Islam in particular, you're going to get into trouble. But also there's such a thing about, like, if you say, for example, in certain aspects of feminism, you can't criticize without being labeled a misogynist.
Sure.
And when you create this sort of atmosphere, then you're forcing people to be inauthentic, to lie about what they really feel for fear of being shamed or for fear of being labeled, you know, something they're not. You know, I know people who have been called anti-Black because they didn't like some of the actions of Black Lives Matter. Right. Not the entirety of it, the social justice people and everything, but they've been called anti-Black. That's a pretty harsh word. I know some people who've been called racists because they oppose reparations, or they've been called misogynists because they didn't think the wage gap was really something of a heavy concern. And that there's a very big difference between hating women and thinking that a fact, you know, presented by some people about compensation isn't true. But routinely you see this conflation. Right, this unfair demonization of people, and I see it all the time. And I operate in leftist circles, and I see it constantly. And I think it's very unfair. And I think that it pushes people who are moderates, who are leftists, to be more sympathetic to somebody who, you know, just doesn't give a damn the way Trump does. What's also what's worse is that many people don't see this shaming as a problem. You know, a lot of people think it's a good thing. It's a virtue. They think shutting down a conversation when they don't like what their opponent is saying is fine. You know, and in fact, even I think preferable to, you know, the messy business of having to debate them.
Yeah, I agree. But I just think these things get applied too broadly. I mean, to give an example, you went on Rubin. We were talking a little bit before recording. You haven't really followed much of his show, but one thing that disappointed me about Rubin, and feel free to not even address this if you don't want, because I don't want you to say, you know, give an opinion of something you don't know about. But one thing that frustrated me, and has frustrated people like Ina on Twitter, somebody I interact with, is under the guise of anti-regressive left and, you know, let's stop this PC stuff, he just has racist after racist on his show. People like Tommy Robinson, people like Milo Yiannopoulos, for fuck's sake, like people that are
so Milo is a very interesting character, right? I mean, Milo is somebody that I think he's somebody I can say more so than I can say for Trump. For Trump, I'll say, okay, part of it, the left bears responsibility. For Milo, I would say entirely he is a media like creation. He didn't have to happen. He didn't have to have the power that he has. He has it because of the backlash that he received, because I mean, it grew him into this cult-like figure. And at any point, all you have to do with somebody like Milo is take him seriously. is just debate him seriously, is not to, every time, you know, he went into a campus and some feminist or whatever it was hollering at him or screaming at him, that gave him power. He loved it.
I agree with that.
I saw this, you know, I saw Milo from his beginnings, from when Gamergate or something, I don't know what it was that he latched onto. I think it was Gamergate, right in the beginning when he latched onto it. I could tell that this is somebody who, you know, he could be no one, or he could continue growing, and he did. And he grew because of the reaction that he got. And every time he got a reaction, he just, you know, grew that much. And his visibility was just increased. And this is somebody who, we have no reason for somebody like Milo to exist. You know, the few times that Milo is honest, or he's giving facts that, you know, maybe worth considering, they have been said by other people, you know, and we should just address them. The few times that he's reasonable, we should just address those times and then disregard the rest. But what's happening is that people are, you know, they're trying to get him kicked off of stage, or trying to get him, you know, no platforming and all this stuff. All it does is empower him. You're creating a monster.
Oh, I agree. I agree with that. I think that's right. And I could be wrong, but I think the first thing I remember him is is it Tim Hunt? The guy, I think that was the thing that he latched onto. Because he battled feminists over the scientist who said the thing that got, someone reported that he said women should be segregated.
No, he was getting bigger before then. He started with Gamergate. But the Tim Hunt thing is also one of those things where I thought that was awful. I thought this guy didn't, you know, we could debate about whether or not it was misogynist, what he said.
Sure.
But I thought it was unfair. The treatment of him was very, very unfair. And it's one of those extreme examples that teaches you a little bit about the way that people are feeling in general.
But here's my question to you. I agree. I agree with that. I actually am fully on your side, on the side of always debate these people. Don't cause violence at Milo's talk at a college. Who gives a shit? Like, he's just going to say some crap that is, you know, easily refuted by facts. Totally agree on that. But the only point I want to make, and let me know if you still disagree, and that's okay, is do you think you should give someone like that a platform, though? Like, do you think that, you know, because Ruben keeps having him on, and I think it's a product of, again, he wants to get access to his large audience, because Milo has a large audience, but he keeps having him on. Oh, let's talk about the fact that, you know, like, all your views, and let's get them out there. And like, there's a difference between saying, yes, this guy, you know, should be allowed to speak at a college if people want him to speak at a college, and shouldn't be interrupted by, you know, loud feminists shouting him down and you know, physically stopping people from entering his talks. I get all that. There's a difference between that and then trying to give Milo a platform on purpose.
Well, I don't know what's wrong about giving him a platform. I mean, CNN gave him a platform recently. I mean, was it CNN? I think, but more recently, when you're encountering somebody who's doing newsworthy things, I mean, as a media figure, I don't see why it's wrong for him necessarily to host somebody like that.
I think it's because, and this may be, again, a product of, I've been following Ruben a bit. I think it's because the line is always, we need the conversation to happen. We need the conversation to happen. And then there's only one person. There's only one side of the conversation. It's not a conversation. It's, you've invited Tommy Robinson, or you've invited the guy with the racist views that it's okay to come on your show because you let everybody talk, even though it turns out you're just letting racists talk. Like,
did you watch the Tommy Robinson interview?
Yeah.
What did you think of it?
I think he's an interesting case because he's somebody who will kind of agree in conversation. I've spoken a lot with Ina because Ina actually had a debate with him on Godless Spellchecker, I think. And he's a weird guy where I think he kind of goes along with you in conversation. And then once you turn off the mic and he's out making news headlines, he's saying racist things again. He's saying, you know, so like that, but that's the kind of thing that you need to challenge him on what he said, you know, like that's something that I don't like that's not happening. He's coming on and he's making nice and he's saying he's putting on a nice face, but then he's continuing his tweets right after that appearance are still terrible. Like, he's still tweeting anti-Muslim stuff, you know, stuff that I think you would if you went back and looked, you would agree was anti-Muslim bigotry, you know?
Yeah, well, to clarify, I haven't seen the Milo interviews with Dave. I have seen other interviews of Milo, so I am familiar with
yeah,
he says the same
thing.
Stuff.
Yeah.
He says the same stuff over and over. I did see the Tommy Robinson interview, and I actually found it to be really, really interesting.
Yeah.
And I've never heard of this guy before. I'm just stereotypically American in that sense that I'm
sure. Yeah,
he's some
more
red
of a UK
guy. I don't know who.
Yeah, he's a UK figure. Yeah.
It was very interesting. And as far as the tweets, whatever he tweeted after, I don't know if I think it's unfair to say that Dave is responsible for, you know, what this guy does, just because.
No, he's not responsible. Don't you think? And that's why it even is more important that Dave at least do some elementary research and say, hey, in the past, you've said that women should be, you know, like all this sexist stuff, like at least bring it up, because people like you who didn't know him, who had no idea who he was, now all of a sudden, oh, he's this reasonable guy on the show. Cool. Like, you know, don't you think it's somewhat incumbent on an interviewer to do some research and say, oh, this guy has said some really shitty things before. Like, maybe I should ask him about it.
I think it may come down to interview style. I think that when I was on, Dave Rubin's show, he didn't give me any hardballs either.
No, he's a softball guy.
I think that's kind of his, interview style in general. So I don't know if I can be, you know, enough, if I can say that this is unfair, because you were
fine.
So nice to him and you were so mean to me, you know, when I was talking, because he's generally pretty, he lets them talk and he lets them present themselves in the best light that they can, which I think is, it's unique in some senses, because you really don't see that in modern, you know, television anymore. I mean, I can't think of anybody where I see that. I can see how he's trying to, you know, model himself after Larry King. And I can see him evolving in his interview styles a little bit. And I haven't been watching some of his more recent stuff. I've just been too busy.
Yeah.
But I'm unsure. I guess I'm unsure for why it's so important that Tommy Robinson be seen as that everyone be uniform in their opinion that he's a super hateful bigot. Because I am, I just watched that one interview, and some of it was a little iffy. Some of it made sense and I could sort of empathize with what he was saying if it was true. And I felt that, he presented himself as fairly conciliatory. He didn't seem anti-Muslim. He talked about, you know, good Muslims that he knew and his work with Majid Nawaz or whatever. And all of that was positive. So what's the harm necessarily with leaving that interview as is, in your opinion, with somebody that didn't know Tommy Robinson, watched that interview, heard all those things, and he wasn't hateful towards Muslims, really, in that interview. And you leave that interview, is the harm just that now they think this person who really
you're giving a platform and a shield to someone who has said really, like, Maryam Namazi, right?
Yes.
Yeah. I actually slightly interacted with this guy on Twitter, with Tommy Robinson on Twitter, because he was saying, he was tweeting Maryam pictures of her nude protest and then shaming her for her body, and was saying, like, he's not a cool guy. Like, he's and it's not like I need him to be crucified. I'm not saying, and I get that. I get that there's this overreaction among PC people, but I don't know. I kind of have a problem with not even bringing up some of these horrible things and then pretending like you're having all the important, hard-hitting conversations, you know? Like, imagine if you were a Maryam and having had this interaction where he's sicking his followers on her and saying, like, oh, yeah, I can't, this is like, it was his response to her making a point about something he said. He said, oh, how about this, where you're check out this counter argument. And then it was shaming her for how she looked in this nude protest. I can even probably find it. I tweeted it at the time. And imagine her seeing this guy come on Rubin and, all softballs, no problem. Like, I don't know, if you were maybe on the receiving end of some of this guy's hatred, wouldn't you feel a little betrayed if someone like Ruben just gives him a platform? It's all happy. It's all smiles. Nothing's challenged. What if he was, anti-black racist? What if he was, don't you think we should at least bring that up? And
let me clarify a little bit about what you said. So the problem is that he is not giving him hardball enough questions, and he really should have, or not had him on at all.
I would say not have him on at all, or at least address, like, I'm trying to think of a good example, but like, if someone says quite publicly, by the way, and not years ago, and not like some random thing, like very clearly horribly misogynistic things, do you not think that you should try to bring it up, like in an interview? Is it? I don't know. I just, it's weird to me. I don't.
Well, I mean, I don't know. As far, I think it's consistent with Dave's style.
Well,
you know,
sure.
That's been his style. So that's what I would expect if he was going to have anybody on. To the extent that Tommy Robinson, you know, troubles me. I mean, he would trouble me if he literally said anti-Muslim stuff like on air, and then Dave said nothing, you know, like if he said really racist stuff. But it seemed to me that he wasn't, I mean, like you said, he wasn't his extreme self.
Well, but
he got to present sort of the best.
Isn't that almost somewhat worse? Like, cause he hides it. Now, I know this is particular to Tommy Robinson. I actually don't think most people are like him. Like, he does a weird thing where he kind of puts on a happier persona than he is on Twitter and in these other news stories that I've seen in interviews and stuff. But doesn't that kind of make it worse? So now Ruben has drawn attention to this guy, and he even, Sam Harris didn't know who Tommy Robinson was and tweeted like,
I didn't.
Oh, this is a, now in your mind, in Sam Harris's mind, this is an okay guy. This is a stand-up guy who just has some good things to say about immigration or something.
Well, that's not true. I don't think that's true. I think it's that, you know, even people that I think are racist or bigots can have some things to say that are interesting or worthwhile. I can have a few points that are worth listening to.
It might be a problem. Let me just real quickly, I'll give you a scenario, see if you know what I mean. If not, it's fine. We can kind of leave it where it is. But let's say you or Sam Harris, which actually happened, tweet, oh, I like this Tommy Robinson interview. Great interview, you know, whatever. When people who have been a victim of or been a target, rather, of Tommy Robinson's hate see that, how do they know that Sam Harris isn't, you know, like endorsing that? Or, you know, like, isn't it somewhat problematic to give this guy a platform to make him look like something he kind of isn't and never challenge him at all?
Well, if it's something that's generally what you do on your program, you have hard hitting questions, and then you don't do it for this guy, it's clearly unfair.
Okay.
If the format of your show is to allow your guests to present them in their best possible light, and I'm assuming this means having controversial people and having put themselves on in the best possible light, I think it's fair. I mean, it's interesting to me that CNN, NBC, I mean, all these places, they always have controversial people. And many of them, you know, there are interviews where they're softball interviews the whole time. But that seems to be okay. Hmm. But,
well, I don't watch CNN, so I guess that's why. I don't know.
Well, I mean, I interviewers in general, they'll have controversial people on, and controversial people will gloss over things.
Well,
and
I think that's okay if you get controversial people from both sides on and do that. But it's only the one side is the thing. He only gets anti-regressive left people on to talk shit about the regressive left. Like, that's the entire thing. So I guess that's why it bugs me, but it's okay. If I get it, you know, if I get your point where it's like the expectation is what it is. And
I don't think the damage is as extreme as everyone seems to think, you know, I mean, if it's not as if, I watched the Tommy Robinson interview and I came across thinking, okay, well, in this sense, you know, in the sense that he presented on there, it seems reasonable. That doesn't apply to his entirety of being. It's not as if, you know, an hour interview, you know, suddenly it makes me feel like this person is acceptable in every sense. And all you have to do is Google him to then see, you know, all the different ways that media thinks about him and all the different opinion articles that have been said about him. So I think in that sense, Rubin's, you know, what Dave did was in contrast to everything else that Tommy has out there. So if it'd be one thing if, you know, nobody knew of all this extremist stuff, but with Tommy, it's so easy to get. It's really hard to get is where he can really just speak his mind and be in an audience that doesn't already hate him or isn't already ready to label him as one way or another. I actually think that I watched after that because the whole controversy happened on Twitter. I'm like, who is this guy? Why are people concerned about him? And then I looked him up and then there was plenty of negativity.
He's awful. He's a really awful guy.
Yeah, there's you know, people that it took his tweets and all this stuff. And other than Dave's interview, I actually can't think of, I didn't find any where it didn't feel like it was just an attack zone where people just yelling things at each other and perhaps correctly when it comes to Tommy. But
well, there are some examples. I mean, like I said, the thing with God the Spell Checker, and then that show actually referenced there was a long-ish, it was like an hour or so. I don't know if it was a documentary or like a piece in, because it was British, so I don't know how the hell their TV works or whatever. But it was a longish piece about him and Mo Ansar, because Mo Ansar was like trying to change his mind or something. So, I mean, he's been given forms before, but I understand. Well, I want to say I think I've taken enough of your time, and let me just say I really, really appreciate the dialogue on this because it's been really fun. Like I like to be able to have the disagreements and hash it out and get your side of things. And I get it. You know, I understand where you're coming from. So thank you so much for at least being willing to go in the paint and have that disagreement there.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me. It was a good discussion. I hope, I could talk go on about any of these topics for a long, long time, but
well, don't say that or I'll make you come back and we'll talk about more stuff.
But this was very good, I think. I think this was good. It was a good chat.
Yeah, I would absolutely love to have you back if there's another topic that we want to get into, because I had a great time and I love talking to you and it was really cool to hear your story and everything. So thanks so much for joining me. Sarah Hayter. Oh, where should we point people?
Well, I have a Twitter. It's at Sarah the Hayter. It's Sarah the Hayter. That's my Twitter. Otherwise, please check out the Ex-Muslims of North America website. That's www.exmna.org. And that's our website. You can learn a little bit more about our organization and what we do. And please, if you have, you know, some time to support us in some way, we would really appreciate it. And that would be really helpful.
Awesome. Yeah, that sounds like a great organization. And it's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks for giving me so much of your time. And I really enjoyed it. So thank you.
Oh, well, thanks. Thanks for having me on. It was fun.
All right, that does it for a great part two with Sarah Hayter. Again, thanks to Sarah for such a great discussion. It was really fun. And a couple things. First, from time to time, I like to remind you about my other podcast. I do Comedy Shoeshine, which check out if you're looking for a comedy podcast. It's not at all like this one. And give that a try. I've found people either love it or they really don't like it. So maybe you're one of the people who would love it. So check it out, Comedy Shoeshine. Just search that in iTunes. Give it a listen. And if you don't like it, your money back. And then also I do Thomas and the Bible, of course. I'm about to finish the Bible, very close. And then I'm moving on to another reading, which is up to the listeners. I put up a poll and they're voting on it. So check out Thomas and the Bible if you're interested in that. Got a lot of new patrons to thank. Thank you guys so much. New patrons are Joel, Al Kling, Martin Fidel, Tim. Oh, man, this is okay. Whew. Okay, so I know I've said I'll read whatever name you guys put. Now, this one, I'm going to read, but I think maybe I just don't understand it. See, it says Blackhawks, and then it has this, like, arrow sign and then sharks. So, like, in mathematics, I get it that maybe that means greater than, you know, but I don't, I'm just going to read it. Blackhawks point toward the sharks, I think is what it means in this context. Again, in math, it would say something crazy like Blackhawks, you know, greater than sharks, but it's not math though. That's the thing. So it's black. Thank you to Blackhawks turning into the sharks, which I don't know what that means, but hey, it's your name. You made it up. And thanks to Mike Wenz, Stephen Henderson, Skeptic Tim, Michael Schrader, Suzanne Wickman, Tronald Dump, Deadeye Nick, and then a patron who asked that I not mention their name. So you know who you are. Thank you very much for your pledge. I appreciate it a lot. And then, of course, I got to thank my all-time greats. You guys are the best. Hunter Ash, Sammy, Inciting Incident Podcast, Along Blackcock, Kaylee Reiser, Zimu Zinu, Adrian Borschoff, Jonathan Moyer, Jay Alden Walt, Blackhawks, Arrow of Some Kind Sharks, Franco Villarreal, Steve Sigmund, Peter Skelton, Brian Gerford, Dale, Matt Garrett, Ian Rosano, Samantha, Sophie, Cara, and that's it. Thank you guys for being my top patrons. I love you guys. You make the show happen, and I hope you are enjoying the bonus content of late. It's been a lot. Next week, I have an exciting, exciting announcement, and you're going to love it. And a returning guest that you will love. I'm very excited. Woo, going to be fun. Okay, so tune in next week. Thank you for listening, and have a good weekend.